feel free to go and grab a cup of tea, because there'll be no tea time in between. And then as long as you do it quietly without disrupting the meeting or disturbing the meeting. All right. The first item on the agenda is opening and welcome. Now, as usual, I'm going to ask that we observe a moment of silence for prayer and meditation, inviting God for God's presence to help us. Thank you. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning to the DPME delegation. Good morning to the staff and all guests. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to welcome back the honorable members from recess. Thanks for your unwavering support in the last term and your hard work. I hope for further support and success in this second term of Parliament for 2017. What I said to the management meeting is that indeed, we have worked very hard. When we look, I can see and I can feel your hard work and I can see the impact. But the dangerous thing will be for us to maintain the status quo. So what I'm expecting in this term is that we take this to new heights. So we take this to the top gear and then we move from there. And it will be wrong for us to be complacent. The more I congratulate you for your good work, the more I expect that you do not become complacent. There's danger. Keep telling people they're doing well, and indeed, if you're doing well, you must be told you're doing well. But then you must promise that you will not be complacent. I wish to welcome you all to this important meeting wherein we will receive a briefing from the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the midterm progress of the MTSF, Medium-Term Strategic Framework. The NDP and the Medium-Term Strategic Framework provide the broad framework in which budget allocations are made. Our main concern as SCOA, Standing Committee on Appropriation, is how far are we in meeting the NDP targets and where should budget allocation and budget execution be improved and enhanced for an accelerated and radical transformation of our country. Now that's where we are. I want to repeat it so that it sinks in and then also inform our robust engagement. Our concern is how far are we in meeting the NDP targets and where should budget allocation and budget execution be improved and enhanced for an accelerated and radical transformation of our country. The improvement also talks to one of our other mandates, which is amendment of the budget. But we can't do it from thumbsucking. It's an exercise that will have to be properly informed. And since 2009, this mandate has not been carried out. And moving forward before the end of this term, somewhere it has got to be implemented because it is our mandate to amend. So that's why we want information so that we can look at where can we improve budget allocation. The presentation should give insights on which areas need to be prioritized for focused oversight and support. Because we are doing oversight over about 40 departments, we have decided that we need to prioritize those that need our attention now. And at least come end of the term, we should be able to look back and say, yes, we've made an impact in these areas. 40. We then thought, it's not going to be possible. We can try, but we must still identify, prioritize departments that we'll focus on and make an impact. So with these few words, I would like to invite all of you to feel free and participate. And in order for you to participate meaningfully, I'd want us to adopt an approach that says, this is our meeting. It is our meeting. It's not us against other people or, you know, but it is our meeting, and it will be in the best interest of the country, of Parliament, but also subsequently of the country, if we can work together and make meaningful and constructive engagement so that we make the impact. If I may use government terminology, so that there's quality outcome of this meeting. Quality outcome. So that there's no wasteful expenditure, fruitless expenditure of us sitting here and we come up with zero. No outcome. Let us have a fruitful and robust engagement on this very, very important briefing. And thanks to all of you. Yes, thank you. I know we were expecting, or maybe I should not preempt, that's fine. Shall we then move on to apologies? Are there any apologies? Any apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson. Guests and committee members and support staff, we received one apology from Ms. Sheila Sopisitole of the ANC. She's not feeling well. Furthermore, we also received an apology from the Minister in the Presidency, Mr. Radebe. He has other commitments. The Director General for DPME also apologized. Busy with study group meeting with the portfolio committee on planning, monitoring, evaluation, as well as public service and administration. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable members, these are the apologies. Do we accept the apologies? Honourable member, Dr. Madlope.
Thanks, Chairperson. I propose that let us accept the apologies and move forward.
There's a proposal that we accept the apologies.
Any seconder?
Honorable Member Imam. Okay, the apologies are accepted, but from myself, indeed, in future, we will appreciate if we don't have the minister. At least we must have the DG here, which means that would make us feel that this meeting is also taken seriously. But because you don't want any wasteful expenditure, in other committees, you would be sent back. But because we would want to avoid a wasteful expenditure, can you please get this message clear? In future, at least if the delegation must be led by the DG, if the minister is not here, the DG must be here, because the DG is the accounting officer. Not what I'm saying, it is in the PFMA. But we then accept the apologies. Shall we then move to the third item, which is presentation by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the outcomes progress in terms of the medium-term strategic framework. Thank you very much. Who will be Dr. Feek?
Thanks, Chair. Can we just make sure before we commence the presentation for this afternoon that it is a correct one that is brought, because I see the date on this one is the 2nd of May 2016. So I just want to make sure, is that an error or is it last year's one that they bring?
You see, I wish the DG was here to tell us whether he's bringing us last year's work or they've re-looked and then improved and bring that. That's why I'm saying we want to be made to feel that we are taken serious also as this committee. 2016, I'll tell you, I know it from, I once taught, I was a teacher at some stage. Then you would have a teacher bringing last year's plan and just change the date for this year instead of planning afresh, injecting new thinking, new strategies, cut and paste. But this was not a cut and paste. They're bringing last year's work to us. That's the impression created by this date. So you have not prepared for us. You just said to pull one of the documents from your files, and then you brought it. And you can't do that when the president has spoken about radical socio-economic transformation, which means you're also supposed to be radical. And before this year, remember, if he pronounced this in February, which means last year's work, we had to sit down and adjust it so that it talks to the radical socio-economic transformation. So if you bring last year's work, it means you have not listened to your president. Yes, and you come from the president. How ironical.
Chair, we wish to apologize for the date. It was the first page. We only focused on the content, and we forgot to change the date, and we apologize for it. But we've been working on the content. It's a new content that you are having, and I wish to profusely apologize.
Well, it will be difficult to believe you. I mean, the first page. You miss the first page, but you are able to concentrate on the next pages. You see, but it's fine. But please, can we take government work serious? I appeal to you. I have been in the civil service for a long time, from 1981. Today's officials are not taking government work serious. I'm able to differentiate because I worked for the then government and I worked for a homeland, and then I worked also for the new government. See, three administrations. Ma? It's okay. That tells you how old I am. I mean, three, but this one, there are always excuses, like now you apologize and we must accept the apology. But what happened? We were not here. We had plenty of time to work. And we requested this report. When did we request it? We requested this report in April, years ago. So from April, could not see the first page. I have a problem. You need to represent this government well by doing your work well, professionally, and also to give quality inputs and outputs. Quality inputs and outputs. It's wrong. Because at the end, you are not blamed. They blame government for failing, not you as officials. So as officials, you must try. Change your way of looking at things, your way of doing things. Change your mindset and assist this government to deliver on this better life by you doing your work as expected. I'm really not impressed, but it's fine. If the minister was here, I was going to report it straight to the minister. Minister, we got work from the previous year after the pronouncement by the president on radical socio-economic transformation. Yes, honorable member.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to express my concern. If I heard correctly, I heard the words, we forgot to change that date. Now, I'm concerned about that forgot, because in my understanding, this should have been a new presentation, a new preparation. Now, if you forgot to change that, that almost convinces me that we're getting something that was 2016. All you did is you forgot the one page to change from the other. Now, and that's what I've heard in my understanding and interpretation. I think you're on the correct. It is me that we. It sounds like this is 2016. Do we have a copy of the 2016 here that maybe we can compare it? Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair, if I may, I apologise for making that mistake on the first page, but I think if members look at the presentation, you would see that there is actually a summary of this year's SONA in this document, and that the budget document, the budget numbers are from the 2017 budget as well. So I can assure you that this is as fresh and as well as we can do at this stage. It is definitely not a repetition of an old presentation. It's, you know, our latest thinking on this complex issue of alignment.
What to change? But you yourselves are admitting, you know? But please help us and help that office, right? It's a higher office. It is supposed to lead by example, and you're supposed to do thorough work for that office. All right, shall we? Sorry, there was an omission. I think, you know what, I think the best, because right now I want to talk to you, but I don't know who you are. But so please, my apology. Shall we get introduction so that I don't assume, or I just call you gentleman over there. I want to know exactly who am I dealing with, who brought the 2016 document to this committee. Okay, shall we start from this, from yourself,
Chair. Of course, Madam Chair, thanks so much. My name is Rudy Dix. I am the outcome facilitator, Deputy Director General for Outcome 4, which is basically on the economy, and Outcome 6, which is on economic infrastructure.
Okay. All right, sir.
I'm John Kruger, and I'm a sector expert in the planning branch of the PME. And I must take responsibility for the 2016.
I'm Dr. Mabuhwane. I'm the outcomes facilitator for Outcome 1 and Outcome 5, which is skills and basic education.
Okay. You said you have 4.
Thank you.
There's an empty chair here, right?
Let me quickly deal with this one, Chair, before I take it. Thanks very much for the opportunity, Chair. My name is Lungisile Phakathi. I work in the office of the Minister in the Presidency.
Okay. So you are the PA or liaison officer?
Liaison officer, Chair.
Okay. All right. Come again. Please speak out, Honourable Member Manana. Okay, what are you saying? Okay, who is the leader of the delegation?
That will be me.
Okay. That's fine, and it's Dr.
Mabuhwane.
Dr. Mabuhwane. Okay. No, that's fine. I don't know if it will be necessary for us to introduce ourselves. I'm sure you know us by now. Okay. There's a proposal that members introduce themselves when they speak. Is that accepted? All right. I know that we've got a new minister in the Department of Finance. So I would like to check if there's anyone, because we have invited the Treasury as well. Do we have Treasury delegation here? Okay, Oh, okay, fine. So anyone from Treasury?
Chair, I'm a parliamentary liaison officer. I'm new here. From this day onwards, I'll be dealing with this committee as well. Yes.
You have not told us your name, say?
Oh, my name is Samuel Mandiwana.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much. You are welcome. We're looking forward to a good and a strong working relationship. I don't know if we should then... Yeah, there are people that are sitting at the back. If they can also introduce themselves so that we know who else is in this meeting.
I'm Zenanda Fukuzan with the PBO.
Good morning, members. I'm Eric Otieno I'm Eric Otieno from Nairobi, Kenya. I've come to visit the Parliament of South Africa. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. You're welcome. Hope you enjoy our meeting. Any other? Yourself, sir?
I am Anthony Ometo. I am a parliamentary monitoring from the parliamentary monitoring group, PMG.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Since you now know who is in the house, please feel free. You are all welcome. Let's engage. I will then move on to presentation by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the outcomes progress in terms of the medium-term strategic framework.
Over to you, Dr. Mabuhwane.
Thank you, Chair. We hope by the end of the meeting we would have recovered from the big boo-boo that we've done. And again, we really apologize. It really has put us on a back foot, so we are trying to really get out of this hole.
Maybe it has put you there, but as long as you move forward, you're conscious of what we expect. Quality work and fresh work.
Absolutely.
I've told my own committee, can't be, we're now taking it to another level. So coming from that office, then it must be even worse. And you can see what's happening. So we need you to salvage us with your quality work.
We hope to salvage that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So in dealing with this, we have two presentations that we've prepared. One is giving an overview in terms of performance around the MTSF, and then we have a separate one that will look at the budget issues, the issues of prioritization, and where we think the pressures will be coming. So I'm going to focus now on the first one, which is basically the MTSF one, and then John Kruger will do the budget part of it. I don't know the issue of the questions, whether we are going to first just do the presentations, all of them together, and then we do questions after, or we want to do the MTSF first, and then we ask questions, and then we do the budget.
Honorable members, I'm in your hands. Can you guide us?
Okay, a proposal from my side, I think we should do the first presentation and then questions and then the second presentation.
Yeah, questions.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable with that?
We are comfortable.
Thank you.
Okay. Basically looking at the structure of the presentation, we'll be looking at the NDP goals and the key levers that it gives us. What we will also provide a context of where we come from, and then we'll then focus on where are we in terms of performance, and then we look at the central challenge, the interventions that we are proposing to ensure that we meet the 2030 goals, and then we provide them the conclusion. The context of the presentation is that we are in the midpoint cycle of the of this government between 2014 and 2019, which requires to reflect on the performance of government against the goals of the NDP. The NDP is the program to advance the radical economic transformation through three key levers that are your economic interventions, capabilities of South Africans, and capacity of the state and active citizenry. So these are the three levers that we find that the NDP says we can use to radically change the country to be able to achieve the goals that we've set ourselves for in 2030. The MTSF is basically the first building block of saying within these 5 years, what do we want to achieve in setting these building blocks towards achieving the 2030 targets that we have. All these 14 outcomes, they are the priorities of government. This is not the only work that government does, but these are the priorities that we believe if we are able to actively engage with them, we'll be able to achieve the goals that we want to achieve. Now, with this presentation, we would also like to focus on those areas which require more determined implementation. As the chair said, we need to gear up to say how the rest of this government, how do we then meet the targets that are required to be able to achieve the 2030 targets. In that, we'll be looking at the capacity of the state, the capabilities of South Africans, mining, manufacturing, financial services, agriculture and land reform, higher education and skills, the SMMEs and cooperatives, and then we look then lastly at crime and corruption. Now, just to remind the members that the three goals of the NDP are to eradicate absolute poverty, to reduce unemployment rate to 6% by creating 11 more jobs, and importantly also to significantly reduce inequality in our society. Now, the key levers that the NDP is proposing is that there should be economic interventions. And under your economic interventions, we have the following outcomes, which is outcome 4, decent employment, outcome 5, which is skilled and capable workforce, outcome 6 is an efficient, competitive, and a responsive economic infrastructure, and outcome 7, which looks at food security, and then outcome 10, which looks at the environment. And then to improve the capabilities of South Africans, that is building the human capital of the country, we need to understand the impact of outcome 1, which is your basic education, outcome 2, which deals with health, and then outcome 8, which deals with human settlement, and then outcome 13, which deals with social protection. Now, to achieve all of this, this cannot happen if the capacity of the state is weak, and if we also don't have an active citizenry. And then the outcome 3, 9, 11, 12, and 14 looks at those outcomes to say this is trying to build the capacity of the state and also ensure that we have active citizenry in terms of achieving our goals in 2030. Basically, what the NDP is saying is that government cannot do it on its own. We also need society at large to be able to meet the targets that we've set for ourselves. Now, before we go into where we are, we also need to remember where we come from. But what we inherited in 1994 was a poorly performing economy designed to benefit a few, and that between 1980 and 1994, the economy only grew at 1.2% a year, with a negative growth in GDP between 1990 and 1992. The share of investment in GDP dropped from 27% in 1981 to 15% in 1993. And then investment by the public sector had also shrunk from 12% to 4% of GDP between 1981 to 1993. South Africa's budget deficit reached 7.3% in 1993. And then lastly, in 1995, it was estimated that 28% of households and 48% of the population were living below the poverty line. Now,
what have we done since 1994? There's been some progress that we would like to highlight that we, as part of our discussion today, that from 1994 to 2012, the economy grew at 3.2% a year on average, from 1.6 trillion in 1994 to just over 3 trillion in 2015. However, we also note that growth has significantly slowed down since 2012. We've also consolidated fiscal spend to enable expenditure on basic needs and social protection. We've increased tax revenue significantly, expanding it from 3 million taxpayers in 1996 to almost 20 million in 2014. We've expanded employment, formal and informal, from 9.4 million in 1994 to 16 million at the end of 2015. We've also grown a vibrant and a successful black middle class. We've also halved poverty between 2001 and 2011. Substantially, we've also expanded the social protection system to cover more than 16.8 million recipients, lifting millions of children and old people out of severe poverty. We've increased access to housing and basic services by building 4 million new houses since 1994, increasing connections to electricity to 95% of households, and 85% of households now connected to water. Now, just looking then at 2014 to 2019, which is now our current areas where we need to be looking in terms of performance. Looking at some of the outcomes that we want to look at, the few slides that we are going to give is to give in terms of progress that we've made, and then following this, we will then go to say where are we still struggling in terms of performance. Now, looking at basic education, we've almost achieved a universal access at the compulsory stage, which is 7 years to 15 year olds. 98% of children are attending 98.8 are attending school, according to the General Household Survey. We've also improved in terms of the performance of our learners according to the Trends in International Mathematics Science Study, which we acronym TIMSS, which shows that we, as South Africa, has seen a remarkable improvement in performance from the 285 score that our learners achieved in 2003 to 372 in 2015. This is, no other country has been able to do this kind of improvement. But we also, even though we've done this great improvement, we also wish to point out that we are still performing the lowest and we are still struggling in terms of our learners have not yet reached the midpoint, which is 400. SACMAC is also indicating that we've also arrested the tide of decline, with learners now improving in terms of performance in SACMAC, which is also an independent testing agency looking at just the Southern and Eastern African consortia. In terms of health, total life expectancy has increased from 61.2 years in 2012 to 63.3 years in 2015. Child health has improved, with under 5 mortality decreasing from 41 deaths per 1,000 live births in 2012 to 37 deaths per 1,000 live births in 2015. Maternal mortality ratio has also improved from 200 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2011 to 138 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2014. Looking at higher education, as a state, we have also invested in our higher education, especially in your TVET, that we've been able to increase the number of students who have access to finance from your 188,000 students in 2012 to over 235,000 in 2015. Number of students enrolled in public higher education studies at universities has also increased from 950,000 in 2012 to 985,000 in 2015. Human settlements We've also increased access to housing. The housing delivered by the state has increased by over 295,000 additional units, over 226,000 households in informal settlements have been upgraded, over 176,000 title deeds have been transferred to homeowners, thereby reducing the previous backlog. Over 219,000 loans have been issued into the gap market by the DFIs and banks. That is the 40% of target at ratio 4:1. In terms of the Operation Pakisha Ocean Economy, since 2014, it has unblocked 7 billion rand in investments and then created over 6,000 jobs. In terms of basic service delivery, over 724 additional households have been connected to the electricity grid. Over 52,000 additional households are connected also to the non-grid. Over 400,000 additional households have access to refuse removal, and then we've also increased the number of households that receive access to water and also to sanitation. In terms of social protection, over 16 million beneficiaries have access to social grant. This is 91% of those who are of the eligible beneficiaries. Looking at all this, we are not saying that there are still no problems in the country, and we would like now to look at some of the challenges that we are faced with. We wish to point out that the majority of black people are still economically disempowered and dissatisfied with the economic gains from the liberation. So despite more than 600 billion of BEE transactions from 1995 to 2015, we note that direct black equity control over the GSE average market capitalization of 11.9 trillion rand as at 2014 for listed companies stands only at 3% for shares directly held by black South Africans. Now, to reach the 25% of black control, an additional 22%, that is over 2 trillion rand at current estimated market capitalization of the JSE is required. This is a gap that still needs to be addressed and funded. Of this, about 60% of the shares are in the hands of strategic triple BEE partners, sometimes referred to as narrow-based empowerment. That is 20 to 25 in community schemes and 15 to 20 in employee schemes. Despite the massive advances made since 1994, there has been insufficient progress in respect of the following: employment, poverty and inequality, black ownership and control of the economy. Overall, the GDP performance has lagged the NDP average target of 5% annually, exacerbating the trio challenge of unemployment, poverty, and inequality. Productive sectors such as mining, manufacturing, and agriculture are actually underperforming and declining in terms of their contribution to the GDP and also declining in terms of growth and job creation. The situation has worsened because of the global economic slowdown with lower metal prices, exports, and investments. Radical socio-economic transformation denotes that there is a need for a fundamental change in the structure, systems, and patterns of ownership and control of the economy and requires putting people at the center. While there are areas of progress on the MTSF targets, overall performance against impact indicators during the 2014 to 2016 is a cause for concern. Impact indicators are of critical importance because they reflect the change that the interventions are making in the people's lives. It is imperative that we accelerate progress for the remainder of this period, the period 2017 to 2019, and act with greater sense of urgency. We need to sharpen focus and deploy resources. There must be a follow-through on decisions made by Cabinet and there must be accountability for poor performance. At the heart of radical economic transformation is an effective state that is decisive in its pursuit of structural change. The performance and capacity of the state to drive transformation is often inadequate, particularly with respect to organizational and technical capacity. And there is also neglect of maintenance and upkeep of particularly water and electricity infrastructure by municipalities, which is leading to a serious decline of critical assets. We need to enforce the implementation of agreed actions to advance the NDP and ensure that there is accountability and consequence for poor performance. Government must exploit to the maximum the strategic levers that are available to the state, such as legislation and regulation, licensing, budget, and procurement, and the charters to influence the behavior of the private sector and drive transformation. There is a need to review the macro organization of the state to reduce mandate overlaps and improve efficiency. We need to strengthen and strengthen planning and implementation, and implement an enhanced performance management system of DGs, HODs, municipal managers, CEOs, and other senior managers across all spheres and entities. Shift municipal planning and financial to finance towards maintenance and refurbishment of infrastructure. Strengthen the capacity of provincial and local government to fulfill its mandates, and then develop a consistent engagement strategy with the private sector. We're also saying that we need to finalize the white paper on the national insurance, implement the transition programs that will take us beyond the pilot phase of the national insurance, mobilize resources for community health worker program, and introduce maternity comprehensive health packages. And that there is a need to provide a comprehensive health care package for learners in grade one in all quintiles. We also need to provide a comprehensive health care package for the elderly persons and persons with disabilities. And then lastly, consolidate the current fragment of health schemes into five transitional models. Looking at land reform and agriculture, many black people still do not own the land in which they were born. There is a slow pace of land reform. Only 8 million hectares of arable land have been transferred to black people, which is only 9.8% of the 82 million hectares of arable land in South Africa. At this rate, it will take us another 40 years to reach the set target, which we suspect this will be a seed for a mass revolt against government. Furthermore, there are over 7,000 land claims outstanding since 1998. We have seen a 19% decline in households involved in agriculture. We have not adequately dealt with the slow pace of transformation to deal with structural and economic distortion in agriculture, such as high input costs. What needs to be done is that we need to provide a differentiated support services for black producers, whether subsistence, smallholder, and small-scale commercial. We need also to operationalize new land reform legislation aimed at establishing land administration structures and accelerating performance, including the Special Planning and Land Use Management Act, Regulation of Agricultural Land Holdings Bill, and Property Valuation Act. We need to fast-track the finalization of the expropriation bill and ensure that the state does not pay premium for land, and address corruption allegations, especially around restitution. Encourage land claimants to accept land instead of financial compensation. Over 90% of claims are currently settled through financial compensation, which perpetuates dispossession. We need to develop and enforce spatial planning to address competing uses of land between mining, agriculture, and housing. Review regulations, trade barriers, and tariffs, which negatively impact on agriculture. review national spend on agriculture against the Maputo Declaration, align water licensing with land reform, prioritize and fast-track land reform with clear time frames, accelerate the implementation on the one household, one hectare program to ensure every household has a piece of land with a title deed. Intensify efforts towards visible implementation of the agri-parks, finance for smallholder farmers, including a review of the land bank to address developmental agenda. We need to fast-track implementation of procurement strategy from smallholder farmers and take advantage of the 30% set-aside. Approve implementation of the 23 initiatives emerging from the Operation Pakisa on agriculture, land reform, and rural development. When you look at mining and beneficiation, black people do not benefit from mineral resources which are overwhelmingly owned by large white-owned companies. The top 49 listed mining companies have a combined market capitalization of 2.6 trillion rands. If all the top 49 listed mining companies had 26% historically disadvantaged ownership as required in the mining charter, the value of black empowerment participation would be at 669 billion already in 2014. However, to date, black ownership in mining is still at 63.9 billion, which is only equivalent to 2.5 of the market capitalization of the top 49 JSE companies. The ownership is still unrealized in the majority of black empowerment transactions. The reason for this is because of lack of profit, lack of dividends, and non-payment of equity. Government has granted mining licenses to diverse stakeholders, but we continue to lack comprehensive data on the recipients of these mining licenses, and thus fail to use issuing of mining licenses as a tool for economic transformation and changing ownership. The mining charter lacks clarity on government's share of ownership, targets for communities and workers, and independent verification of the triple BE contribution. State has not effectively intervened to promote beneficiation, including leveraging strategic mineral sector to supply downstream industries. Operation Pakisa has identified the need to develop strong beneficiation strategies in iron, steel, platinum, and silica industries. So what needs to be done? Is a need for a revised mining charter that will provide clear targets for government share of ownership, communities, and workers. The charter needs to be fully aligned with the triple BE code and include improvement, enforcement, and reporting mechanism. There is a need to consolidate and leverage the state mineral holdings, promulgate the amended MPRDA, utilize mining license regime to increase transformation and participation, track who has benefited from mining licenses since 1994, ensure that there is transparency in the issuing of mining licenses, conduct a baseline audit of all mining licenses, and establish a monitoring and reporting system for mining licenses. Utilize IDC and the DFI investment to support mineral beneficiation. And lastly, appoint a level panel of strategies to identify certain minerals and industries for government-led development. When we look at manufacturing, the manufacturing share of GDP has declined from 21% in 1994 to 13% in 2016. Employment continues to decline with 2 million employed in the manufacturing sector in 2008, falling to 1.68 million people in 2016. Government has been successful with industrial policy in sectors where we have worked with stakeholders and where we have been decisive. But we have not built strong black ownership, and consequently, there are very few industrialists and manufacturers. We've also failed to finalize the preferential procurement policy framework and the 30% set aside. We have not been able to effectively monitor and develop reporting mechanisms to measure government departments and SOCs on meeting local procurement targets. Despite the strong competition authority, we continue to see high level of concentration in manufacturing and other sectors of our economy. What needs to be done to remedy this situation? We need to pursue domestic industrialization strategies, especially issues of beneficiation, instead of depending on export of natural resources. Speed up the rollout of black industrialist programs, drive local procurement through the amended PPFA, enforce the revised BBBEE code, enforce competition law to open up manufacturing value chains to new entrants, increase research and development spend as part of budget reprioritization in order to strengthen innovation capacity in innovation. Then there is also the challenge of the financial services. Banking ownership is still an illusion for black people. Financial services accounted for 22% of GDP and 14.7% of total employment in 2016. Growth in most services is higher than growth in the rest of the economy since 1994. Financial services have grown on average by 4.5% between 1994 and 2016. Market share of the four top banks stood at 89% at the end of 2015. Total banking assets at the end of 2015 amounted to 3.6 trillion rands, comprised mostly of loans, while banks' main source of funding remains deposits. What needs to be done? We need to review the financial sector charter target as it leads to access to finance for SMEs, financial inclusion, and affordable and low-cost housing. State and the bank should develop a mechanism for shared risk to lower the cost of borrowing at the lower end of the market. National Treasury, Department of Telecommunication and Postal Services, and the Reserve Bank should resolve the outstanding issues around the license for the Post Bank. The Reserve Bank should create enabling conditions for creation of new banks, such as cooperative banks, agri-banks, and construction banks. Ensure certainty by harmonizing measures to stamp out money laundering and corruption as outlined in the Finance Intelligence Center Act and related amendment bill. The SME sector contributes around 42% of the GDP and employs 47%. The SMEs have a potential to be major drivers of growth and employment in the country. Support for the sector, however, remains highly fragmented and requires increased resources to ensure its sustainability and growth. High levels of concentration impede this sector's growth. So what needs to be done? We have to consolidate and strengthen differentiate business support for SMEs and cooperatives, strengthen access to finance of SMEs and cooperatives, implement the 30% set-aside regulation for SMEs and cooperatives with a particular focus on vulnerable groups such as women, youth, and people with disabilities. Improve monitoring and reporting mechanism on SMEs. Ensure that the SOC set clear targets and reporting for SMEs and cooperatives. And then invest more money into infrastructure projects, prioritizing townships and rural areas. Looking now at at your DFIs and SOCs, that the DFAIs and SOCs have a critical role to play in advancing the NDP and the radical economic transformation. To leverage this, this potential, we need to ensure lending practices of DFAIs promote access to finance by black people at affordable rates. So it's not only access, but the cost of borrowing. Ensure closer monitoring evaluation of impact of DFIs, and through the IMC on SOCs, accelerate the reform and rationalization of these SOCs, and implement a presidential review report on them. Looking at infrastructure investment is critical for any growth for this country. So we need to prioritize key projects for water, transport, energy, broadband rollout, and social infrastructure. Renewable Energy Independent Power Producers Program is important and will remain a growing component of our overall energy mix, having secured the $200 billion of investment thus far. However, conflicting messages on the program have resulted in policy confusion and uncertainty amongst investors. Reprioritization spending is needed if we need to change the infrastructure trajectory. We need to reprioritize spending to ensure delivery on critical and key infrastructure projects and maintenance, ensure policy certainty and direction by reaffirming our the renewable energy as part of our overall energy mix, and ensure the financing of the REIPP project is clarified. Develop a revised timetable for digital migration with clear accountability mechanisms instituted if targets are not reached. Ensure that the broadband spectrum dispute is resolved urgently. Increase investment in socio-economic infrastructure, invest in innovation and digital technologies to prepare society to leapfrog through the disruptive technologies that are coming. Although the World Economic Forum records South Africa's improvement in ICT ranking, South Africa's performance is poor compared to its peers around ICT. South Africa is ranked 126 in terms of prepaid mobile cellular and 69th in terms of broadband internet tariffs out of the 143 countries. It is ranked 119th in terms of download speed out of the 143 countries, with our average download speed at 4 megabytes per second compared to OECD countries, which is at 19.6 megabytes per second. South Africa has relatively low levels of ICT uptake and access in terms of broadband, and this is largely as a result of high cost, low levels of access, and poor efficiency. Slow progress in resolving our ICT challenges will result in the opportunities presented by the fourth industrial revolution bypassing South Africa. What needs to be done is that to take advantage of the fourth industrial revolution and take advantage of the new technologies such as artificial intelligence, 3D printing, and resource efficient sustainable production and robotics. These will affect the way we produce, manufacture, and repair products. While this must be embraced, we must mitigate the negative effects of technologies on jobs and inclusivity. To take advantage of this requires having math, science skills to support technological changes, as well as urgent measures to ensure delivery of key telecommunication infrastructure, notably broadband. We need to take decisive action to speed up digital migration to extend broadband opportunities and resolve disputes on selling of the spectrum. We need to leverage ICT to create opportunities, increase access, and reduce cost of communication for black people. Looking at higher education and training, We noted that we over the past two decades we've invested a large amount of money in post-school education, and we have there's been an increase in access. Interventions have been implemented to enhance the entire value chain from schooling through to higher education and training. However, limited skill supply to the economy remains one of the binding constraints to economic growth. Despite level of expenditure compared to our international peers, our schooling system is still performing very, very bad. And we are also experiencing declining number of artisans that are being produced. When you look at the labor market, we know that in South Africa, chances of employment are higher if you are better educated. They are even better if you have a university degree compared to a TVET qualification. It is important, therefore, that as we try and expand the TVET college system, we ensure that it's expanded with issues, taking into account issues of quality. And we also know that chances of unemployment are lower for those with more education. What needs to be done? We need to deal with the issue of fees as quickly as possible so that the system can focus again on producing the skills that are needed. We need to convene a summit to reach consensus on the future model of student funding. We need to develop a quality and relevant curriculum for our TVET colleges if we are to continue at making them attractive to our learners. And then we also need to ensure that we facilitate the placement of 30,000 artisans per annum through MOUs with our SOCs, industry, and TVET colleges. We need to implement education plans which are closer aligned to the needs of the economy. We need to increase numeracy and literacy at foundation phase through the improved teacher expertise, accountability, and active participation of our parents. We need to strengthen foundation courses to support first-year students and at TVET and university, as we know that most of the learners who attend universities, they drop off during their first year. Fully implement the articulation policy to ensure seamless transition from your TVET to your university or from your community colleges to your TVET system, and establish a social compact to increase accountability of national and provincial departments, school districts, principals, teachers, and unions to focus again on learner performance. With crime, despite progress in preventing and combating crime, its levels are still unacceptably high. Just under 80% of people feel safe walking alone in their areas during the day. 31% of people feel safe walking alone in the area during the night. Drugs and substance abuse are a major drivers of serious violent crimes. There is an increasing number of violent public protests, which include destruction of public property. The transnational organized crimes like human trafficking, vehicle and stock theft, illegal mining, illegal trafficking, and consumption of narcotics remain prevalent in the country. Now, what needs to be done? We must ensure that we have police visibility at community level, including regular program joint operation. We need to strengthen partnerships with communities and other community organizations in the fight against crime and corruption. We need to mount increased intelligence-led projects to eliminate organized and transactional organized crime syndicates, foster and maintain joint border operations, categorize damage to state property as a serious offense, increase community awareness and participation to defend constitutional gains on the right to protest. And then on corruption, high corruption levels undermine good governance, legitimacy and credibility of the state, sound and functional institutions, as well as effective operation of government. Private and public sector corruption hampers development efforts. Important steps have been taken to counter corrupt practices and to put in place accountability mechanisms. Very little indication that private sector is taking steps to combat corruption within its rank. National Anti-Corruption Forum is dysfunctional, but we have insufficient prosecutorial, investigative, and forensic capacity. What needs to be done? We need to impose consequence by acting against fraud, central oversight on large tenders, strengthen coordination of multi-agency anti-corruption system, strengthen other anti-corruption legislation, resuscitate National Anti-Corruption Forum, strengthen investigation and prosecution, promote ethical conduct in the public sector, and finalize the National Corruption Anti-Corruption Strategy, which addresses both public and private sector. As a milestone towards 2030, the target output for 2019 are a significantly more engaged and active citizenry, involved in a well-established participatory governance structures and other community and non-governmental platforms. However, the Active Citizenship Index, which measures the levels of involvement of people in their communities, indicated a relatively healthy level of 68% in 2015, but declined to 61% in 2016, indicating that much more still needs to be done to take the index to the 2019 target level of 85%. Despite the progress we've made over the last two decades, income poverty remains high and inequality is as severe as ever. We have a long way to go to reach the NDP targets of dropping poverty, of creating 11 million jobs, and reducing inequality. We have it within our means to achieve the transformation we are seeking, but the state needs to play a leading role and use the levers at its disposal to accelerate change and to realize the radical economic transformation that is needed. It cannot be business as usual. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation, Dr. Ma Bukwan. Am I right?
Yes.
Indeed, it was an elaborate presentation that has given us insights on the issues that were addressed or focused on by the presentation. So, honorable members, I'm going to now open this for your reflection and engagement with the presentation. Let's reflect on the presentation and interrogate the presentation. Dr. Madope, Dr. Sik, Honorable Member Snukwanyane, Honorable Member Ntlangwini, Honorable Member Imam, in that order, Honorable Member, I have not forgotten your name, McLaughlin. And then Honorable Member Twabaza, Honorable Member Manana, in that order.
Then Honorable.
But then Honorable Member, if you can be short and to the point.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. We welcome the presentation by...
I'm sorry to interrupt you again. Give us three questions per member. And time allowing, we'll allow you a second bite.
Even if we have got two, we must give you three. It's a maximum.
No, okay. No, you're right. It's all right. Maximum of three and not more than that. Then you'll be given another opportunity
okay.
If you have got more.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. We welcome the presentation by Dr. Mokwana.
Mabukwane. Ne. Mabukwane.
Mabukwane, yeah. Yeah, because it gives us where we come from and where we are now. But this particular medium-term strategic framework is for 5 years. He has done a presentation for things that need to be done. My question is to say that has this department shared these things that need to be done with different departments that are supposed to do it, because it's not them that are going to do it. And also around the issue of the planning, we're of the view that planning, monitoring, and evaluation department, when it was introduced, we are not going to see departments working in silos. But even today, we are still seeing departments not doing well around the issue of planning, and also still doing the planning in silos. To this program and the priorities set by the government, in this current juncture, the way the department is operating and the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation not really hands-on around the issue of the planning of the department to plan together. And today we are still facing the under expenditures because of the lack of correct planning. What is the view of the planning, monitoring, and evaluation around the issues of department not planning in accordance, which lead to under expenditure, compromising service delivery, compromising the dealings with the unemployment, as we indicated that this is the focus of the government at the moment. What is the role of the planning, monitoring, and evaluation in this planning in silos of the department and failing to spend in accordance so that we get what the chair was saying, that we get quality outcome around that particular matter. Going to the issue of radical socio-economic transformation, I think it's page slide number 12. You indicate that radical socio-economic transformation denotes a fundamental change in the structure, systems, and you continue. How do you think, what is the view of your department around the issue of implementing this radical socio-economic transformation, where you have also indicated that the majority of the black people still do not own the land? How are you going to change the structure of the economy if the majority of the people of South Africa does not have land? Because you can't have radical socio-economic transformation without people owning land, the majority of the people of the country. And how I understand the issue of the system, you can change the system, but the patterns of ownership without the people having land, the control of the economy by the majority of the people if they don't have land. How are you going to achieve that goal of the government without this? You did indicate that there is a slow pace of, you know, people getting the land, but at the same time we are talking about 2014 to 2019 to really focus on the priorities of the government in achieving those priorities. Do you think your presentation, as we have indicated, that from 2014 to 2019, where we are focusing, are we going to really deal with the issue of the unemployment, inequality, as well as the poverty in this situation where the people, the majority of the people, does not have land? Thanks, Chair. We'll come back.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm going to try and be brief. a few questions for clarity. First one, slide number 7, you indicate there that 95% of households, 85% households are connected to water. Now, in that calculation, are you talking about all, is that the people that stand in these streets waiting in a queue for one tap? Is that included in the calculation, or that calculation, does it include people that have their own tap that is connected to their own house? On slide number 10, I'm just a little bit, I need clarification on that one. The statement at the bottom of the page indicates that there are 16 million beneficiaries, well, nearly 17 million beneficiaries for social grants. But the information that I have somewhere in the back of my mind is that there are 5 million taxpayers. On slide number 7, you indicate that there are 20 million taxpayers. Now, let's look at whatever the figure is. And as I said, I'm going to use the figure that I have that are paying the majority of your tax revenue. Is that sustainable? Can you comment on that? That, in other words, 5 million taxpayers paying 16 million social grant beneficiaries. And then on slide number 37, again, I have a statement that I just need you just to comment on, because you make a statement that if you have a university degree, you stand a better chance than if you have a TVET. Now, I cannot understand that statement, because it's supposed to be two different types of qualifications that are university and TVET. So somewhere there's a problem if you compare those two qualifications and saying that you have a better chance of getting a job. Thanks, Chair. That's my three questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Perhaps my first question would be in terms of the TVET students. I see here that the number that's receiving financial assistance annually, which is inclusive. My question would be perhaps, are there other students in addition to this that are not receiving financial assistance? I'm saying this maybe in relation to the skills needs that we have, and I know that we are trying to encourage our students to take up courses that will skill them, because somewhere you have also something that we also know that we do have a skills challenge in the country in relation to our economy. So just to check if these are all the students that you are funding, or you have other students besides this that are getting financial assistance. Perhaps the other. I'm just trying to choose the questions that I want to ask. Then the other question that perhaps I would like to ask is, in terms of some of the challenges here, you say that we need to accelerate progress. I'm actually reading here. It is imperative that we accelerate progress for the remainder of this term, the period 2017 to 19, and act with greater sense of urgency. Is there any particular approach or plan that you have in place to accelerate that, to accelerate the progress here? Because as I can see, there's just so many challenges. Then perhaps I must ask a general question now. The one thing that perhaps I'm missing in the presentation, quite comprehensive, but I'm just missing one thing, is in terms of what program, what impact are we making with the NDP? Because I do see all the challenges, I do see all the, you know, what needs to be done. But perhaps if you've got some concrete issues that you would like to share with us to say, in spite of these challenges and what we need to do, but these are the achievements that we've made to date with regard to the, to the. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is on page 5, Chair, and I would really like to come back for a second round as well. On you mentioned the capacity of the state on the through the three key levers on the NDP. And I just like to know how does this affect fraud and corruption affect the capacity of the state if you want to achieve your NDP goals? And what have your departments do in this department or in departments or individuals that was caught with their hands in the cookie jar of eating state money and so forth? Then the next one is on page 19. You make mention on ensure that the state does not pay a premium for land. I just like to know what do you mean by a premium in that statement that you have made there. And then there's another one yet again on the resolving the fees post-school system on page 38. And then your how you're going to solve or resolve this fee issue. What plans have your department put in place? And also with the narrative, sometimes we as people, we believe that anything that is free is cheap. So with that narrative into higher education, in free fee education, in resolving this post-schooling fee problem that is taken ground. That is all the three that I have for now, Chair. I will come back.
Thank you very much. Next.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation. However, I have some concerns in terms of the credibility of the statistics that you have given us. The information I have and what you give me is not, I must admit, is different. And I'm going to specifically talk about the issue of health. The information that you're giving us here is this life expectancy is what, going in 2015 to 63.3. I don't know where you get that from, because that stats has never been released. In my understanding, we've gone to 62 and nothing more than that. So I don't know where you're getting that 63.3 from. Again, you talk about the child under 5 mortality decreasing from 41 deaths per 1,000 to 37. I don't know where you get it, because that latest stats had showed 39 anyway. Your maternal mortality rate, you're talking about that it improved from 200,000 in 2011. It was about 268 or 267 at that time. It has increased, and it's standing, I think, at about 155. To your 100, I don't know where you're actually getting that information from, so I'm a little bit concerned about having to rely on the information that you're providing us with here today. The issue, you know, I think one thing we must all admit, it looks very bleak. We are nowhere near, we'll never achieve what we want to achieve. So the question is, what is it we are doing that we are not going anywhere near reaching our targets? It's either almost, you know, we talk about some successes, but they're very limited for what I can actually see. You know, for me, most importantly, maybe what I want you to do is explain to me what is your interpretation of radical economic transformation. Because I have an idea of what I believe, what I want for our people. And I don't know what is your view in terms of that. But remember, when I'm saying this, I'm taking into consideration that presently, 3 people in this country own, and I think I've said this before, equivalent of 50% of the world, 50% of the population of the country. So the inequality is we're nowhere near closing the gap, and I can't really see that. We talk about housing, the number of housing units that we have, but then I think it's to a very large, very misleading. I think we must compare that in line with what do we still need to do in being able to provide the housing, and to what extent we have an increase every year in terms of the increase in population or the demand for housing. And surely I would, my understanding that the way we're doing it in terms of providing housing, we're never going to reach that and provide housing. And remember, I think I've said this before, your dignity, your identity comes from where you stay, your land, your house, and whatever it is. Maybe we need to change the approach in terms of, my view would be rather give people service sites, let them build. Because if you went to all the informal settlements, I think 80% got DSTV in their houses. To be honest with you, they got DSTV, they can afford that. Beautiful cars parked outside there. Question is, why must it be your responsibility as government to be able to give them all houses when you can provide a service site? And like at 50,000 rand, you've got 500 rand a month to pay. You can pay for DSTV, 400 and whatever it is. You'll be able to get a much better house because, you know, for me, if you want to address radical economic transformation, we must not forget quality. Putting these little shacks, these one-room shacks, and giving the people, clouding them all together, no recreational facilities, you're not changing their lives, believe me. That environment is what creates havoc, and it goes on from generation to generation. So I want you to see what is your views in terms of what you've established in terms of your process that you follow, that you believe we must shift away from if we want to come anywhere near achieving these things. You also talk a lot about the tenders and the big ones, and we must not forget corruption is from the ground. Let's not forget the private sector and the role they play in this corruption. The corruption is not only government. If there's no private sector too, there's no corruption as far as I'm concerned. Let's be honest. But what we're forgetting is the corruption at the lower level. And let me tell you this, what, under 500,000? Where you don't need, you just need a three quotation system. Add all that up together and see how much will come. That is why the ex-CEO said 40% of your 600 billion rand in goods and services is overpriced. And that's where it also starts. So I want to see where we're going to actually go. And I'm going to stop there. I've got 49 questions.
But just hold the other, give you another chance.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you another question.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much,
Nick. Thank you, Chair. Yes, this presentation, thank you for it. It contains a lot of information, but it also doesn't contain a lot of information, if you follow what I'm saying. And the impression I get is that we've been given a very slanted picture. And I'd like your comment on it. If I can elucidate what I'm saying to an extent by, for example, if we look at slide 6 and 7, in the last bullet point on slide 6, you say, in 1995 it was estimated that 28% of households and 48% of the population were living below the poverty line. Progress since 1994, you don't tell us how that's changed. You don't use that same set of parameters and say it's now so much. You say increased access to housing and basic services by building 4 million new houses. Since then, 85% are connected to water, 95% of households connected to electricity. How has it affected that 28% of households and 48% of the population living below the poverty line? That you don't tell us. So we left imagining, is this still the case or has it changed? Are you hoping we're going to look at 28% versus 95% and things have really improved? It's deceptive. And I'd like your comment on that. Another example I could use is if you look at slide 5, it tells you all people in South Africa are and feel safe. This is the same one my colleague over there mentioned. But if you look at slide 39, and remember this is under capacity of the state and active citizenry. But now, this is something the state should be doing, surely. But here, slide 39, it seems to put the emphasis on private citizens. So, you know, the state's like backing off and saying, well, actually, it's the citizens' fault. So unless the citizens come to the party, we can't actually do it. But it's the state's job to provide a police service. It's the state's job to provide a criminal system. Okay, citizens can certainly help, but don't put the burden on the citizen and say, well, it's because you're not doing your job that we can't actually cope with the crime problem. It's because we don't act against the crime. That's the problem. We don't have the laws. We don't have the enforcement. there was another place here where you said prioritize making destruction of public property. That's on slide 41. Categorize damage to state property as a serious offense punishable by a long-term sentence. That's already the case. Malicious damage to property is a criminal offense, and it can receive a long sentence. But why don't we do it? Why do we not have the capability to say the police must investigate, bring the evidence to court, and the court must prosecute, and the courts can then implement the sentence? That's our problem. We don't use the laws we've got. We keep thinking introducing more laws and costing more and more money in the process is going to solve the problem. Without some kind of buy-in and enforcement of the laws we've got, we're never going to achieve it. Anyway, bottom line is I'd like your comment on the fact that my impression is that the slide is or the presentation is slanted. If we look at slide 11, you say here, and I'd just like some clarification, black direct equity control over the JSE's average market capitalization of 11.9 trillion as of 30 June stands at 3% for shares held directly by black South Africans. What do you mean by black equity control over the JSE's average market capitalization? Control indicates members of boards where they can make decisions in private companies. Is that what you're referring to? Or are you referring to people having the control in the sense of I can buy or sell my share? I'm not quite sure what you're referring to here. Does this mean individual black people? Is that what you're talking about? Because then tell us what the same percentage is for individual white people. What's their equity control over the JSE's average market capitalization? Because when I look at it, I mean, indirect, what is the indirect percentage that's held through pension funds, through all sorts of other institutions that invest in the stock exchange? Banks invest there, insurance companies invest there. A lot of people have investments in banks and insurance companies and things like that. So this picture, again, is skewed because it's trying to say it's only 3% of blacks who have an interest in the stock exchange, which is way off the truth. In fact, black people own more shares in this country than whites do, from the JSE's figures. But you're giving us a skewed picture again. But I'm saying it's not a direct thing, it's through the indirect means. Then my third one, if I can go to slide 16. So there are two slide 16s, so I'm just referring to the first one, which is capacity of the state, what needs to be done. And it's basically an example of another criticism I have of the presentation. You make these very broad statements, but you don't give us any backup. You don't say how we're going to achieve any of this. The one I'm thinking of here is strengthen the capacity of provincial and local government to fulfill their mandates. Well, how do we do that, and what exactly do you mean by it? I mean, most local governments, their problem is money. They don't have the funds. Whether for good means or bad, they don't collect the money that's due to them. The equitable share is too small for the needs they have. Whatever the case may be, they don't have enough money. How are you going to strengthen that? Are we going to give them a bigger share of the budget? Are we going to encourage them to borrow money on their own more? Because they do that already. It's not included in our national debt figures, but they certainly all borrow money when they can. I have a problem with this approach. This is just sort of a general sweeping statement. Strengthen the capacity. Yes, it's fine, but how do you do that? What exactly do you mean by it, and how are we going to achieve that? Thank you, Chair. I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
Alpha?
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me go to slide 9 and just ask this small question. On that very last line, on the beneficiaries of social grants. I do want to know what has happened to the remaining 9%. Of beneficiaries. On slide 11, the very first paragraph where you are talking about 600 billion rand of BEE transactions from that year to 2015. You know, it would be more informative if you could break that down to the number of SMMEs and cooperatives and their sustainability. In other words, are they all of them still operational and growing? To the number of jobs, I know that in one of the slides you make you did refer to some 40 something percentage contribution to GDP, so that's fine. But at least if you could have a breakdown of that, so that we have an idea. One of sustainability. And two, of the contribution to job creation. The last one for now, Chairperson, would be slide 30 to 33, where you're talking about infrastructure. You have correctly said that some concrete steps need to be taken towards attaining the 30% set aside for SMMEs and cooperatives on government procured goods and services. You are not saying anything at all about the 60% set aside for youth in the infrastructure build program. What's going on there? If you could explain that. Chair, I will come back with some more.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine is on slide 9, where we talk about higher education and training. And the statistics with regards to TVET, I'm not convinced that it's true, because the report that we received previously were contradicting to this. The issue of the university that has increased for the enrollment, but what is the pass rate at the end of the day? There are certain issues with regards to agriculture. On page 18, where we talk about the decline of the household involvement in agriculture. What are the causes of this? And how can we address it? Slide 19, on the allegations of corruption, especially in the institution, what are these allegations, if you can be clarified so that we are all on the same path? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
With your permission, may I add one or two questions? Well, if you look at the very first page of your report, Doctor, you are saying this is a high-level progress of MTSF from 2014 to 2019, say high-level, okay, of progress. But then, as you present, I found that your presentation is a narrative more than giving us information on where are we now from 2014 to this mid-term. Where are we now in the 14 outcomes? And you chose to talk to us about 9 outcomes. Now, 14, 9. What made you to leave the others out? Because we're interested in the progress in the 9 outcomes that you are overseeing. as this department. And we need to get concrete responses on what are the things that have been done and where are the bottlenecks. Concrete. Not a narrative like, for instance, just to illustrate my point, on slide 11, you say majority of black people are still economically disempowered. Now, sitting in that office, fully deployed to plan, analyze, monitor, and evaluate, and you've been doing this on a quarterly basis, what has made you not to give us the figures here? Because from other corners, for instance, we have learned that 95%, I'm talking about figures, 95% of the country's wealth, is it 95 or 85? Please correct me, 95. 85, yes, 85, sorry. Of the wealth of the country is in the hands of 10% of the population of the... Now, this is what you're supposed to be telling us, to say... Not say majority of blacks, say so much, the percentage, because figures don't lie. And the figure gives you a clear picture so that you should know whether there's a movement or there's no movement. And then if there's no movement, then our interest would be, what are the bottlenecks? Why is there no movement? So you see here, you're giving us a narrative, doctor. And we're not satisfied with it. Again, I'll tell you, In your narrative, you keep giving us information, which I think it is stale information. You talk about 2015. We're in 2017, sir. Mm-hmm. If you're sitting there on a daily basis, on a quarterly basis, working on these things, on your doing focus on your work, you should be giving us information on the 2016 update, not 2015. You said we are at midterm. Now, midterm means that 2016 also you have information, you've scrutinized information from 2016. So we should be sitting here and get the 2016 information, not 2015. And somewhere you give us 2016, somewhere you give us 2015. Why? What is the problem? Because we are now 2017. We'd like to know how far have we gone with the implementation of those 14 outcomes as at the end of December, because you're giving us December 2016. This is the problem we have, that I don't think we're taking our work serious. And somehow officials want to come here and tell us what we want to hear. We're not interested. We want to hear how far have we gone in ensuring that the country changes for better in terms of the NDP. All right, and then, slide 9, there's something that I wanted to, observation on slide 9 that I've made. All right. Dot. Slide 9, human settlement, I think the bullet number 3. 176, 423 title deeds have been transferred to homeowners. Now we're talking, remember, the accounting period here is 2014 to 2016, but you remember, yeah, 2015 to 2016. High level progress of MTSF 2014 to 2019. 2014 to 2016. That's the information that we want to hear. That's the latest information, 2016. For 2015, you're still behind with 1 year, which means you must still come back and give us the latest information. Now, you then say 176,000, am I right? Am I reading the figure correctly? 176,423 title deeds out of 820,000 in the 3 years. What have we been doing? Are we really serious about changing the lives of the people? Just issuing out title deeds. I'm not talking because the houses you must build, but issuing out title deeds so that people can feel dignified and, you know, confident that they own something. 176 out of 820, Baba, what percentage is that? And also maybe in future, if you give us, you must give us, you know, in columns so that we can see. Say, if you say 176 out of 826, which is this percentage? Well, the percentage is the one that is talking to tell us whether we're moving or we stagnant. You should have picked up this one up, and in terms of your monitoring and evaluation, you should be telling us to say whether we are moving or we are not moving. And if we are not moving, what are the bottlenecks? Because your work is just that, monitoring and evaluation. Just every day when you go to the office, monitoring and evaluation, okay? You will then give a report, a quarterly report. Every day you wake up, you go to the office, monitoring and evaluation, but this is where we are. When we have this, this one was is a strategic structure. That's why I say, we don't want to be desperate to get information. We want to look at where can we shift the budget and which priorities do we think should get more money as we move towards the end of the term. But you see, this report is also not helping us. Instead, it's frustrating us because there's no work is not happening. Has not been happening for the 3 years. 176. Can't what are the officials doing when they wake up and get to the office? All right? This is not, it's not high progress. What did you say here? High level progress, okay, but it's not. I think there's information here that is outstanding. You're not giving us what is happening. What has happened and where are we and what needs to happen? What are those bottlenecks and what need to happen to those bottlenecks? It's not just a story. We want to feel a move from stage one or phase one, phase two of the end, of the implementation of the NDP. I'm sure the last one that I would want to look at is page 27 is my third question. My third question. You must count correctly, Mr. Imam. Page 27, eh? You see, page 27, market share of the four top banks stood at 89% at the end of 2015. Now, we want to know, now, where is it standing now? Now, at least we can use the information of 2016 information. Is it not available? Okay, you listen. Total banking assets at the end of 2015 amounted to 3.6 trillion. My argument is we're getting stale information, one the latest information. I don't know if you also make use of Stats South Africa to get the latest information, because there I'm sure you would be having the 2016 information. Stats South Africa. It gives you the latest information. So maybe you will have, you will respond to that one. But in the main, the frustration that I'm picking up from members, they're getting a narrative. We're still not getting a picture of the 14. You've picked up the few. Why not the 14? And where are we in terms of all these outcomes? And what are the bottlenecks? Thank you. We will then hand over to Dr. to respond to the issues raised by the honorable members.
Thank you, Chair. So it's 34 questions. So
it's
I'm going to try and merge some of them, because some of them are talking about similar things. So,
okay, sorry for repeating ourselves, but I'm sure it's out of frustration.
Okay.
You may proceed.
Okay. Chair, a little bit on the issues of data, is that what we are trying always to make sure is that we use verified data. So going, for example, in my sector, which is basic education and skills, you'll see that we don't have 2016 data there, because 2016 data will only be available in October when they have audited the data. So we are always afraid to give data that that has not been audited, because then it can turn out that actually we were reporting wrong information. So we are always trying to find the latest, but the data that has been verified, it becomes always, so that as a result then there's always a delay. Dealing with the frustrations that you are having, one of the issues that I mean we can be able to do is basically to give the House some of the reports in terms of the outcomes themselves, which will have the tables that you are saying, that can that go into the nitty gritty rather than at the high level as we have done. When we're saying we're providing high level, we're not saying only it's only the success. We're not saying the achievement is big, but we're just saying this is where the progress that we've done, and then we've gone then into each of them to say, here we are struggling, here we are struggling. Unfortunately, it came out as a narrative rather than us giving you maybe the numbers. So I'll take that. On the TVET side and the issue of your university and that we are comparing not same fruits, it's the unit of analysis there is your probability of being employed. NDP is clear that we want to increase the number of learners who are attending your TVET colleges. Now, if those students actually get that qualification and yet they get frustrated in getting employment, then that means we are not making, we are not advising our students correctly for them to be able to take TVET instead of going for a university. So we are saying the issue of quality is an important thing. You'll see when John is going to be presenting that we are actually we've reached a red zone where the targets of the NDP will never be met in terms of enrollment, because the funding has put a ceiling on how many learners we can enroll. But as DPME, we are saying increasing that enrollment, and we are not taking care of the issues of quality. It is also much a dangerous thing to do, because those students, when they get qualified, they get frustrated because they can't be employed, because employers don't trust the kind of qualifications that are emerging. So that is why we were raising the issue of that, what are your probabilities of being employed versus the TVET and the university. Then the issue of silo planning. As DPME, we've been encouraging departments to actually plan together as part of the outcomes. But trying to force departments has been a challenge, in that departments still prefer to be working alone. And therefore, with the outcomes approach, we've been forcing them to say, even if you are a department that is dealing with education, you know you need health, you know you need DST, you need these other departments to work with you to be able to achieve your targets. So we've been encouraging them in terms of when they're signing the delivery agreement within the MTSF to say you need to work together to be able to achieve the goals that that have been set for you. And then looking at the... the issue of the TVET students who are we looking at the numbers of the total students. It's not the total number of students who are enrolled. We are looking at those who received a funding. So there's a difference of those who are actually enrolled and those who are receiving funding, because the important thing is making sure that the poor children actually get funding when they access the TVET colleges. And this becomes a challenge for us going forward in terms of the budget constraint, means that we will have actually a constraint in terms of having more of the learners coming in. What are we doing for the universities in terms of fees must fall?
as a department, we've been looking at modeling on what are the challenges, on because it is an important issue to say, if we are going to provide free education, how are we going to fund it? Where do we get the money? Where do we cut? Because the cake has reached almost finite, and so what you call trade-offs have to be done. And now it's now trying to do those modeling to say, when you cut here, how much are you having on the impact of society? It is a very important issue to say, what do we deal with the, how do we deal with the issue of quality? That if it becomes free education, will people still treat it as a valuable investment? We are suggesting that we need to also, when you provide free education, there needs to be rules of engagement. For example, we know that in Britain in the past, you used to have what you call lifetime students, who, because we are providing, they just continue doing degree after degree after degree without completing. So there is, well, when we're thinking of providing free education, there must be rules on ensuring how do we ensure that learners actually take this serious, because this is a government believing in the learners, and you must make sure that you are able to complete within the time. There must be penalties if you don't complete within time. But even when we put those penalties, we must ensure that you've been provided with the basis that we want. That's why we are talking about foundation courses that universities need to have to ensure that our learners are better prepared. So most of these are about economy. So I'm going to give the outcomes facilitator on the economy and infrastructure to deal with them. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Where we are unable to respond, I think we'll indicate that, and if it's okay, Honorable Chair, we can provide written responses. But I thought perhaps just two issues that Dr. Mabuhani was talked about. On the data stuff, absolutely, Honorable Chair, there is a close working relationship between ourselves and Stats ESSET, and that is being harnessed as we speak right now in developing accurate and much more detailed statistical information. We use a whole range of different data information sets. Statistical South Africa, of course, with its different data sets, general household survey, quarterly labor force survey, all the various surveys that are required to be able to inform us. We also use Reserve Bank data. Then there's also information that we have to verify, where we get information from different departments in relation to their particular data that they keep themselves. And that's an important exercise for us to be able to ensure that the measurement is accurately. And there are lots of criticisms that is always raised when we do that. Then there's, of course, independent data sources that are used either by the private sector or, for example, NGOs or different institutions. And I think it's important to be able to highlight those kind of concerns. But in answering perhaps, I mean, I think what we've done in the presentation, Honorable Chair and members, is that we've taken a slightly different approach, and we note the concern that you said that you wanted to see the separate outcomes. But we've taken a different approach, particularly because we think that there are three key things that the NDB talks about. It's about reducing household and income poverty, it's about reducing unemployment, and it's about reducing inequality. And the view that government has taken, and which we think is quite critical, is that to be able to achieve the priorities that are set through the National Development Plan as an overall arching vision of where we want to be in 2030, that a program of radical economic transformation is fundamental to achieve that. And what we've done, is to basically identify key areas where we think that radical economic transformation needs to be implemented to be able to achieve those objectives set in the NDP. So we've taken a slightly different approach, and we must then say, well, Honorable Members, if you want us to specifically identify the outcomes, we can do that. But we thought it would be useful to hone in on those critical areas that we've identified in the presentation that we think are key areas that can fundamentally address poverty, that can fundamentally address unemployment, and can fundamentally address ownership and inequality. And so this is the kind of approach that we've taken to be able to say this is the emphasis that we need to look at for the next next half of the period that is there. So I thought it's important that we provide that kind of context. And in response also to one of the honourable members that have indicated this presentation in somewhat different forms have been presented to cabinet and endorsed by cabinet. So we want to look at honing in and saying, do we monitor this, because we think this would have the biggest impact and the best outcomes that we have. You know, so it's education, it's issues around ownership in the economy, basic education, it's around land, it's around financial services and financial sector, it's SMMEs, it's around corruption. I just mentioned a few, there are many other areas, but we think these are the most important areas from our point of view as DPME to focus on to be able to make those kind of fundamental transformation that we talk about in the program of radical economic transformation. So I thought perhaps just, Honourable Chair, that kind of area is done. We take the concerns around the working in silos approach, and I think this is something that we need to improve on. Honourable Member, that is absolutely an important area. We had some successes on doing some of this. For example, in the area that I work in, which is, I don't know if honourable members have heard about the adoption by cabinet of the socioeconomic impact assessment system. And the socioeconomic impact assessment has fundamentally helped us to be able to support through a planning function of coordinating the work of new legislation, new policy, new regulations that come up. And we've been able to bring together, and I can provide lots of examples of where, for instance, where some departments would, as a responsibility, let's use one example, the Department of Health, on the new amendments on the tobacco legislation. Now, although it's a health function to manage the tobacco legislation, there's a significant impact on other departments that may have to manage their stakeholders in relation to that. Small business, for example. Because if you, for example, say that we want to introduce bland packaging, which is, you know, just no branding, and we want to have cigarettes below the counter, that has an impact on SMMEs who, for example, have a lot of their sales in cigarettes, you know, despite the fact that we need to, as South Africa, because we've taken the decision that health is quite critical and tobacco legislation has to be strengthened to ensure that we discourage people and young people, particularly from smoking. So we've been able to bring together departments to coordinate and address those concerns and do that, but I think that is noted. Absolutely. I think that's very, very important. My point early on about ensuring that we focus on this, and we think these are the critical areas that we need to look at in terms of ownership and distribution in relation to that. Honourable Fick, the 3% is direct black ownership. So it's you as an individual and it's you what who for it. Sorry, not on Robert Fickers. Your question around the 5 million taxpayers. Yeah, I mean, the point about is that the social grants system that we've introduced, the extensive social grant system, one of the best in the world, by the way, particularly the CSG, the child support grant. I mean, it was introduced specifically to be able to ensure, number one, that we deal with redress and the system of the social grants that was predominantly designed for white unemployed males, by the way, right? Fundamentally, it deals with those kind of concerns. Now, of course, I mean, ideally, what we want is full employment. You know, so as we move towards employment, we get less people onto social grants. And, of course, full employment also means more taxpayers, right? Registered taxpayers, including those who contribute VAT, and, of course, increased company tax, because, of course, there's an assumption that you employ more people based on profitability and that you're able to survive. Now, of course, I mean, that is a debate, but we can't forgo the social grant system because it is one of the successes of government. It's fundamental in that if one looks at the social grant system, it for many households, particularly in rural communities, it's a matter of whether you're able to provide basic needs or not, whether you're able to provide food, you know, or some food needs, and I think that's very, very important. What we need to do, and part of what we say as radical economic transformation, is fundamentally trying to shift the dependence of grants to full employment. But we have to do that in a systematic way. So as people get into employment, it is assumed that as full employment, as we achieve full employment, or let's say the target of 6% unemployment that the NDP talks about, that we get more people weaned off social grants and into full employment. So of course that's important, but I think one must not undermine the significance and the importance of continuing to pay social grants under the current circumstances, because our economy is at a difficult stage. You know, we're not growing in the way that we want to, we're not creating the number of jobs that we require, and therefore social grants will become a particular challenge. We need to manage our finances, I think, in a way that ensures that we don't cut social spend, right, because it's not only the grants, it's health, education, and some of the other areas, but that we need to ensure that some of the spending is directed as catalytic spending towards improving private sector investment in the economy and growing those kind of opportunities that we have. Sorry, I'm just going through the questions so I don't miss any of them, Honorable Chair. I thought I'd answered some of what we mean by radical economic transformation. We think this is, if we implement the NDP, is that not the radical economic transformation? And I think what we're very, very clear that the National Development Plan is fundamentally certain aspects of it. If we fast track it, that is important. That is what we've referred to as radical economic transformation. I think it's quite critical to emphasize that radical economic transformation is not simply about narrow-based ownership, because you put the ownership stuff in. It's about how we increase the broad-based ownership and control of the economy and participation. So it's through various forms. It's through ownership on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. It's through ownership through small SMMEs in township economies and access to various markets. It's about workers getting ownership and share into this. It's about getting employment. It's a whole set of broad-based interventions that we think are quite critical that we point out of here as an area of what we refer to as radical economic transformation and meeting the targets of the National Development Plan. So I thought that would be important that we do some of that. I thought that the presentation is actually, Honorable Member, I thought that the presentation is actually not slanted. I thought we paint a pretty bleak picture. You know, I mean, one has to recognize that there's some successes that we've had in relation to the social sector. We've done quite, Dr. Mabuhane shows these results. I mean, we've been lagging quite significantly so on education. And some of the results finally show that we're making significant turns around education, and particularly around maths and science. That's really significant. We've made significant progress around health. We've been able to ensure that more than 60 million beneficiaries get social grants. We've made significant progress around women's settlements, around access to various forms of basic services. So that social aspect, which is in our control, I think we've done pretty well. We need to sustain that and ensure much, Honorable Chair, as you mentioned, that we make much more faster delivery. I think where there's aspects which is not in our control, like the economy, which is literally 75 to 80% controlled by the private sector, is where we've done weak, and I have to admit that upfront. We've not used adequately our mechanisms, our levers, to be able to change the economy and ensure greater employment and deal with inequality. So we've not used those levers, and we tried to, Honorable Chair, in the presentation, talk about those levers. Those levers, for example, make reference to DFIs, SOCs. We've not used those levers. That is in our control. So even the state sector, which contributes 25 to 30% to the economy, is big. It's huge. What levers are we using there to be able to ensure that we change the kind of patterns? And it's around procurement. It's around funding small businesses. It's around dealing with the direction of the economy. Another lever, for example, that we've not used adequately, for instance, is the issue around how we deal with slow place of land reform. This is in our control, and we need to expedite those kind of interventions. And I think this is very, very important. Another lever that is in our control also that we've not used effectively is charters. So we want to talk about new regulation. In actual fact, we would suggest that we need to use effectively the mechanisms of regulation that we have, including charters, which is the black empowerment charters that we have in finance, that we have in mining, that we have in some of the manufacturing sectors, and use these kind of levers much more effectively, which is in our control, to be able to ensure that we deal with the kind of targets that are there. So I think that, we played on the one side, and I think that we've made some significant progress. But in the economy, I think we have to admit that. We have to admit that we're not creating the kind of jobs and employment that we want. We're creating jobs, and I think it's very, very important, honorable members. But it's not sufficient to absorb the newcomers that are coming. So we have about 500,000 to 550,000 new entrants into the labor market every single year. Those are the people that finish with degree, right? And then opt not to go to university, right? They enter into the labor market. They're new labor market participants. We're not able to absorb them fast enough, given that we still have a high level of inequality. And I think this is something we've not done significant around inequality. And so the point around the 3%, it is exactly that. It's direct ownership, honorable member. I have an interesting figure here, and this is I thought it's important to give this figure. It's from the JSE, and let me just do this. That actually shows. So the total equity ownership, total black ownership, and that includes for pension funds, is either somewhere between 20% and 23%. So you're right. But we're talking about direct ownership here, and that's very fundamental. So it's important that we not hide behind pension funds, because pension funds don't necessarily reflect only black members who are pension funds, you know? So that's very, very critical. White ownership estimate, I must emphasize, this is 2030, right? Getting any data from the JSE or any other statistical organizations finding chicken feed, right? It's very difficult. As part of our commitment to cabinet, honorable members, we are developing an exercise to try and develop much better sense of the ownership patterns in the economy. And we want to work with the economic departments to be able to do that. So, honorable member, again, white ownership is estimated at 38% at 2030, the JSE. What is significant? Direct, 38%. So we can have an interesting debate around, whether white ownership is less than black ownership. I think one of the biggest problems that we have is, and there's a kind of conundrum that you sit with, is in actual fact, foreign ownership has significantly increased. So I want to use the JSE figure. So the total foreign ownership in 2011 was 34%. In 2013, it was 39%, and I must say it's an excess of 45% right now, if I see some of the data that is there. So you had a significant influx of foreign ownership of equities and shares. Now, of course, it's important because you want foreign ownership, but you want foreign ownership in direct foreign FDIs, so foreign direct investment. We want into productive capacity. But what we've seen is huge amounts of capital flowing into our JSE and into our bond market. And this is exactly what has happened. It's good, but it's risky, right? Because uncertainty, as we see, creates an opportunity for people to say, okay, actually, we're selling our shares. So as quick as that money comes in, as quick as it goes. Unlike, for example, FDIs, they are huge sunk costs, huge capital investments, and it's not so easy to move if there's policy change, for example, on some of these things. So I thought it's important that we can clarify on this, but again, I must emphasize, I would treat some of the data from the JSE with a pinch of salt. We're meeting with the JSE. We've been meeting with some of the people that keep data around ownership, and we want to try and track this in a way that is much more reliable. There is no official data source on ownership, unfortunately, in relation to this. So that's covered, 600 billion rand of transactions. Honorable member, again, I hope I've answered the question. It's very difficult even to get which percentage of that is women compared to men. I must be honest. It's like, again, finding chicken teeth, right? You're just unable to find even the breakdown of what that black ownership is, right? What we do know is that the JSE keeps data around, broad base, which is like data on, for example, on BE partners, which is direct. And then you have community schemes, so they have to report on that. and then on employee schemes. So we can provide some of that, but this data doesn't say, you know, it doesn't, we also, so how much of them are women? You can't tell us. So we're trying to find it. How much of them are SMEs? How much of them are youth? There's no data on that. So I think this is one of the challenges that you sit with in trying to measure. So at least we have a base, you know, and we then say, okay, this is the base. So many young people actually have share ownership in the JSE. Let's use the JSE as a proxy, right? Because it's only one form of ownership that we talk about, you know, equity share ownership. And then you move forward. But and I think this is the challenges that we have with. Honourable Member, absolutely right. I'm unable to give you exactly the progress. I tried to find the data on the 60% targets of youth on infrastructure set aside. If it's okay, can we provide your response in writing to that? I'm unable to find the figure right now in relation to that. And then I think I've covered, Honourable Chair, I think I've covered your questions also in the initial thing around data and the MTSF stuff. Oh, on the top four banks, yes, again, that's Reserve Bank data, and it comes out in the middle of the following year. So unfortunately, I must say it would not have changed significantly, Honourable Chair, that the 89% of the top four banks' market capitalization, which is in excess of 3 trillion, it is 2015, and the report is provided much late in 2016, so we use the 2015. The 2016 report, which is an annual report that the Reserve Bank provides, is not available, unfortunately. So we're still using the 2015 data from the South African Reserve Bank.
I think that covered a lot of this stuff. Just perhaps on the data, two things. I think there was a very specific question on the health data. And, I mean, what we'll have to do, according to my knowledge, those are the latest data from Stats SA that we have. But we'll send through the specific reference for that data. Then I have to make a preemptive apology that in the next presentation we also use 2015 data for most of it. And that is really because for some data we don't have the 2016 or 2017 data. So the last week I've been talking to Stats SA, and there are about 50 emails on this, to try and get even a 2015 poverty data. So what the NDP said, 39% of poor people are poor. What was it in 2015 or 2016? The response from Stats SA is there was a living conditions survey in 2015, and the data will be released in May 2017. So that data, so, I mean, even though we do try very hard sometimes, you know, we want some of the data is not even available for 2016. Thabo referred to higher education data that must be ordered. The same with things. So one does struggle to get an up-to-the-day data. We would have hoped to have 2016, at least 2015 on most things, but some of them that are just not available. So as I say, a preemptive apology for that, and we've really on these areas tried best to give you the latest data, but sometimes to compare different things, you know, one takes something a year back so that you've at least got 3 or 4 data sets for those and not just these odd numbers. Thank you.
Okay, honourable members, please, you've received responses to the issues that you raised. Are there any follow-up questions? Honourable Member Imam, Honourable Member Dr. Peak, Honourable Member Dr. Madlope, Honourable Member Mr. McLaughlin. All right, Honourable Member Tlangwini. Honourable Member Manana, in that order, Honourable Member Gwabaza, in that order, but please do me a favour, just be short and to the point. Even the responses should take the same format, short and to the point, because we want to catch, at least we must be able to understand the real issues, not the whole story. The issues, how are you responding? Because the constituency must be responsive. Yeah? So we want to capture
that. Thank you, Chair. Due to my fundamental right of freedom of speech, I will limit it to 2 questions. I see you don't pay enough attention in these reports to some of the very major challenges we face in the country, with 2,000 new infections of HIV every week in the country, and the impact it's going to have on achieving success in this, and including the issue of TB and diabetes, you know. I see you don't pay enough attention to that. So for me, there's a con. I would also like to see you give us comparison, because I know a lot of politicians generally don't want to get there because it's all about votes. But I want to be realistic. The issue of sustaining some of these grants is just not possible. Now, from 1994 to now, 2017, the child support grant increased from 4 million to 17 point almost 2 million. Now the question is, where is it going? You know, when I'm going to say now, some people are going to not agree with me, where people say they actually only have babies to get this grant. And you and I know you can never sustain a child with 350 rand or 300, you can't do it. Yes, but that's exactly one of the things. Now, from 4 million to go to 17.1 million, something I think, and I'm not saying we must discontinue the grant. No, the grants are helping to address the inequalities of the past. But can you see the message also? You need to compare at what rate these children are being born in the country and look at the difference, 13 million in the last 20 years. We need to start looking at that holistically and saying, listen, is there a challenge? Is it giving the wrong message? What should we do differently without depriving those currently in getting those grants? Now, I could be selfish and say, no, I must not say anything about it because I need those votes. It's not about the votes. Do you know what is going to happen to a child with 350 rand a month? I'm not even going to the issue of where it's being exploited, where parents are working and still collecting the grant. It's a total mess. It's just not being controlled properly, to be honest with you. But I'm concerned whether we're giving the correct message that 17 million people in the country, you understand, are collecting grants in South Africa. Is it correct? Should we not be trying to change that and trying to create an environment where people can earn and reasonably well, improve their quality of life rather than living just on social assistance? Old age people differently, but anybody other than that, I'm saying, or disability, yes. I think we need to look at a model how we're going to rather change those people's lives. You know, you don't even have a mechanism in the country where those that are getting grants, you can try and create an environment for them to be absorbed into the working market, you understand, based on having that information available in terms of their skills and things. So you give them the grants, it should be a temporary thing, then taking them to a better quality of life by being employed. We don't really have those systems in place. So for me, whilst you've addressed some of the issues in terms of radical economic transformation, for me it is first of all the kind of house you live, the environment you live, how safe and free it is, what do you earn, are you able to sustain yourself, can you get your dignity back, you understand. I think all those things for me is very important. I'm one of them that's totally against this RDP houses, to be honest with you. One room, half a dozen people, 10 people living in one room, you know, this is where you get indecent. It's not acceptable. If we want to address radical, for me, it is about changing the life from the ground. Take the poorest, take from the rich and give the poor, if that's what we have to do. But we have to change their life in every aspect to improve their quality, including the education. If you go to the schools, I want to tell you, we've been on a visit, the quality of education, you talk about an ideal school, nothing is happening. There's no health there, there's no sports there, there's nothing there. So I'm hoping that the next time you come, you're going to look at all those different aspects of how we take an impoverished person and change, transform their entire life to a better quality life. Let me stop there.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Briefly, on slide number 9, that information given about the loans that have been issued. At this point in time, do you have information regarding the recovery rate of these loans? In other words, we don't want a situation where they converted to grants. So do we have a recovery rate for that? And then secondly, the issue regarding the, on slide number 11, I just, need clarity on this, and this is not a political question, it's an economical question. Because of the information given, they're saying that direct black equity control over the JSE's average market capitalization of 11.9 trillion. And now you're saying that, okay, the statement given, and I'm not blaming anybody, the statement, the focus seems to be, in my view, maybe a little skewed. It seems as though this transformation means that you're taking away from one to give to the other. Whereas, should it not rather be that your economy should grow, and in doing so, you're involving more people? Because that is seems to be the message that is given there, because you're saying, okay, fine. So you're taking, black people only got 1%. You want to give them 25%. Where's it coming from? It must come from somebody else. So is that really what the focus should be? Or, and sorry for repeating my question, but just so that I make myself clear, should it not be then we, and somebody mentioned it, that you now must have more inclusivity. In other words, you must increase your database. And in so doing, you'll obviously increase your tax base, and you'll increase your tax revenue, and so forth. But if you're going to do it that way, where you're going to sort of reallocate, from, in my view, there's not going to be any improvement in the economy. Thank you.
Are you talking about reallocation or redistribution of wealth in the country? Okay. Because your radical socio-economic transformation is linked to redistribution of wealth so that we can also close the gap between the, you know, the two economies of the country. Close that gap, narrow that gap, so that there's equality versus the inequality that is experienced in the country. Am I interpreting your question correctly?
Yes, Honorable Chair.
Distribution of wealth to narrow the gap.
What I'm saying, and the question is that as long as you are not making other people rich and you're making the people that were rich poor, that's what I mean, then you're not, in my view, the economy is not achieving its objective. And I just want to make sure that if that's what I understand, is that there's a way, but if it's that way, in other words, there's a way of redistributing wealth, but if you're taking it from one to give to another, then all, the economy is not benefiting. I just want to get clarification on that.
Right, next.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks for the responses, but I want to really get an understanding. When the Chair was opening this meeting, she indicated that we want to know and understand how far in regards to the meeting of the key priorities of the NDP or its objectives. What I want just to understand, if the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation was going to rate the progress in regards to the implementation of the NDP, where can they put the progress? Is it 25% or is it 40%? And when they continue, they said the context of the presentation is the midpoint of the electoral cycle 2014-19, which requires reflection on the performance of government against the goals of the NDP, as the Chair was saying. So if we leave this meeting, where can we say we are around that particular plan of the country going forward? To give a clear understanding, are we at a 10%? Are we going to achieve, I'm saying this, Chair, because on slide number 13, they said it is imperative that we accelerate progress for the remainder of this term. If we are saying we are accelerating, where are we? What needs to be done
are we going to achieve it? We want to know where we are. We are in the mid. Are we at a 50% implementation of those key priorities? I'm having that, you know, that understanding. But lastly, Chair, around the issue, maybe they can share with us, because they are planning, they are monitoring, you know,
they evaluate.
How far the job fund, is it creating an expected outcome that it was designed for, job fund? Because we are talking about the issue of the employment, unemployment. Are we putting money where it's supposed to be put? Are we getting value for money for this? Maybe they can share with us. Thanks.
I must again apologize. You can hear we are struggling to drive a point at home. As we speak, we now are repeating ourselves, though, because we can, even in your responses, you're still giving us a narrative. You're not giving us facts that will make us to have a picture of what still needs to be done in the 2 years, because let me be honest, we've committed to say in the 2 years, we must make sure that those things that were supposed to be done in this during this term are done by the end of the second year, and we are left with 2 years. We are so clear about that. We're already focusing on 2019. But what still needs to be done so that in our oversight, we then put emphasis on those things so that those things are done before 2019. You must remember, whether we want or not, after this, there'll be a new term. So we can't talk about 2030 is coming, but our mandate is limited to 2014-2019. So that's where our focus is. So the facts are then the ones that are going to assist us to take informed decisions in terms of amendment of the budget, so that we redirect the budget to those things that we say they must, whether we want or not, come 2019, these ones must be implemented. Do you understand that? The impact. It's not us. We moved from output-based to an outcome-based. So we're now on the outcome. Where are we in terms of those? So that's where the question is. And we sound like we are repeating ourselves, Doctor, as you put it. But you can see, you're not giving us the answers that give us the information that will help us to do our work even better. Because we're looking at 2019, we want to assist this government. Because partly, if the departments don't deliver, we told ourselves here to say, we will be equally to blame. Because it means we will not have done our work as expected. Now, do you understand where we are? We're in 2019, so the figures, you know, and then actually when you do your monitoring and evaluation, do you know that it doesn't end up there? You also make recommendations and concrete recommendations. That's why I say, if you, she's repeated what I've said actually, I said, no, where are the figures? You say this, but the figures. So I want you to understand that we're not just repeating ourselves for the sake of repeating ourselves now. We're not getting what we want to get. We're not meeting for the sake of meeting. I said to you, we don't want at the end of this thing to say to ourselves it was wasteful expenditure. There was no impact. So I think you please listen carefully again, and then but where you don't have, you can then say no. We realize that we have not given you. Now, as we go back, we will ask our researchers, because we don't expect you to do it yourself as well. We expect you to have quality researchers who will then dig and give you the facts. All right. Next. It was, yes, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can just make a follow-up comment on the stock exchange and the aspect of shares and owning shares. This is under the heading on slide 11 of ownership and control of the economy. I just want to make the point that the stock exchange isn't the economy. You know, in my other life, I'm an attorney and I deal with deceased estates a lot. I have more black clients than white clients. White clients are inclined to invest in the stock market. Black clients invest in property. Every single estate I do for a black person, there's more than one property. They own three or four properties. The whites don't. They own one property, but they'll have some shares. The stock market is a risky place. I know. I don't own any shares in the stock exchange because I've lost money there before when I tried to. You put your money in the bank, you know you're going to get your 3% interest. You put your money in the stock exchange, you know you can lose it, which you won't at the bank. So it's a risky place. Not everybody wants to invest there. So it's not always a good indicator of ownership of the economy in that sense, because people are, there's an aversion to investment in the stock exchange as well, because it is risky. Okay, if you get, it's like a lottery. If you get a lucky, your money goes up nicely. But if you don't, you lose it. And there's no comeback. There's no guarantees. So I just wanted to make the point that it's not a be-all and end-all kind of measurement. Then on slide 14, you make the point at the top that the heart of radical economic transformation is an effective state that is decisive in its pursuit of structural change. That phrase, structural change, worried me a bit. Is this in relation to the third bullet point where it says neglect of maintenance and upkeep, water and electricity infrastructure? Are you talking about infrastructure kind of structure? Or are you talking about the actual structures of government? Because if we wanted to change all of that, aren't we really on rocky ground? I mean, what are we going to do? Change all the departments, change the way we operate, change parliament, scrap parliament, have a different kind of system altogether? Is that what you're talking about? I'd just like to understand, because it's a scary sort of expression, structural change without some kind of qualification. And then on slide 15, changing the subject again, capacity of state, what needs to be done? I referred to it a bit earlier as well, but it's again, you know, in my opinion, your department, to an extent, is employed to come and tell us the obvious. And we've got lots of other departments that do the same thing. There's a lot of overlap between yourselves. We've had the PSC for the last 3 years come and tell us about, for example, you speak here about the enhanced performance and management system for DGs, HODs, municipal managers, and so on, telling us only 18% of those in these kind of positions actually had signed performance agreements. They just refused to do it. And we were asking, well, how then do you say things like there's been an improvement and people are earning bonuses? What do you base it on when then not even signing performance agreements? And we've known this. We've known it for 3 years already. And what's changed? You're now coming and telling us we need to implement an enhanced system. Why don't we use the system we've got and just implement it? It's again, all we need to do is apply the laws we've got and we'll change everything. You know, on the first slide you have here, you speak about the NDP goals. Eradicate absolute poverty, reduce unemployment, significantly reduce inequality. If our economy was operating as it should, all those would be sorted out, because that would be the effect of a good economy. So the whole thrust should be, let's fix the economy, because then everybody benefits. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ned.
Thanks, Chair. I have one suggestion to make, Chair, in relation to the information that are being used in your percentages and so forth. If you, next time when you do your presentation, just include to where you are sourcing your information from. So then it makes it easy for us also as reference when we are using the documentation in our next or other committees or so forth, then we can quickly see that, okay, you get this from CFSA, so you get this from National Treasury and so forth. It will make it much, much easier. And then again, on the mining, for me on page 12, there's a statement that was made about the mining, manufacturing, and agriculture, which is underperforming and declining. And then underneath, there's the situation has worsened because of the global economic slowdown with lower metal prices, exports, and investments. So is that the only situation that has contributed to the underperforming in these three sectors? Or were there other elements as well that could have contributed, because from where I'm sitting, I really been tense. Like, the statement is like very contradictory. Like, I would say there is still other factors that have contributed. Maybe you just wanted to maybe shorten it down, but also if you can't answer it now, if you written response is perfectly fine by me. Page 13, on yet again on accountability, and it sort of slots into some of my colleagues that have mentioned earlier on. We have time and again we have heard about these performance contracts that were not signed, and how, like, is there a political will for this accountability? Because to just put the word blankly there, like, it's not going to help, because from where I'm sitting, yet again, like, we don't have an accountable government. We have a government that decides and wakes up in the middle of the night and just take decisions. So we don't have an accountable government. Is there political will? And what your department, you are monitoring all of these departments, what is your role in ensuring that this accountability, the term that you forever throw in your slides, are implemented? I think, and then, yeah, yet again, on page 19, maybe I've missed it, and maybe you did spoke about it, on the premium for the land. So on that one, what do you mean by that term on the premium of the land? And that's it, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Chairperson, I'm not sure whether my question on agriculture will answer. I didn't hear anything.
Can you assist us by repeating it so that if it's not answered, then it gets answered this time around?
No, I asked about the allegation there, the restitution, what are they? They never said anything. That decline on agricultural, household agriculture, what are the causes? Those are the issues that I raised.
Okay. All right. The follow-up question from me is, when I said, remember your responsibility in your planning and monitoring and evaluation is to deal with all the outcomes. And then in your response, say you said you chose these ones and Cabinet adopted these ones. When did Cabinet adopt this report?
No, let me correct that, Honorable Chair. So we're still reporting on all 14 outcomes quarterly, but this is a reprioritization of saying these are the areas that we think we should focus and give much more priority to. We are still reporting on all 14 outcomes. So let me not be misunderstood, and it was adopted at the Cabinet Lokhotla early on this year.
Okay, I'll tell you why I'm asking. Because, you see, our work, is to follow the money. After allocation, appropriation by the Department of Finance, we then follow the money of all the departments. So, and I then said to you, when we get that, we then prioritize those that need. So which means our priorities will not be your priorities. You see? So if you give us a holistic report, it will then help us to decide which ones are we prioritizing. I said you must show me the letter that we sent out to you, but it will disturb me for now. So I was trying to say, we still, as this committee, we still need this other information, the